Hello and welcome back to the official Scottish Rugby Podcast. I'm Jamie McMillan. With me as always are Chris Patterson, Al Killock and Rachel Malcolm, and our special guest this week are Professor Jason Leach and our very own Dr. James Robson.
Well, delighted now to be joined on the podcast once again by Professor Jason Leach, who's the National Clinical Director for Scotland, and our very own Dr. James Robson. Professor Leach, I'll come to you first, if that's okay. First of all, thank you very much for coming back on and updating us here on the podcast. But as always, if you could just give us a general update of the current situation in Scotland, please.
Yeah, Jamie, it's good to be back and nice to see you all. I see you've kept Chris off furlough, so it's nice to see him back again. And Rachel, I'm not sure you were with us the last time, so it's good.
No, I don't think I was actually.
Good to see you again. And James and I have got to know each other, fortunately or unfortunately, over the last little while. And it's good to see you, James. So I'm afraid the answer to your question, Jamie, is not as positive as I was the last time we spoke. So last night I did some media and I looked up the last 7 days of cases. So the numbers over the last week, and we're at 4,000, the highest weekly total for months. You can't have missed that about a third of them are in under 19, 20-year-olds, quite a lot of halls of residence, quite a lot of universities going back. They're not immune to serious disease, but most of them won't get serious disease. But I looked at the age profile last night, and 80 of those 4,000 are over 80. So that really worries me, that you do not do well from this disease if you're over 80. So that's why you can see us discussing, as is France and Spain and Germany, everybody discussing what else we need to do. You can't tell where the sweet spot is for the R number and what you're allowed to open, but it would appear that we've just gone a little bit too far and we have to reverse. And that's mainly household connections. That could be hospitality, could be your own houses. So we've already put in pretty severe restrictions around who you can visit and when you can visit. And it's horrible. It's really horrible to have to do that. But so, Jamie, the fundamental answer is the virus in Scotland and in Europe is accelerating again.
On that, Jason, before lifting the restrictions from lockdown first time round, I assume there'd be a huge amount of planning and preparation and almost an expectation that there would be a rise. Is the curve steeper than planned or shallower? Is it about what you expected?
It's a really good question, Chris. The modelers told us, basically, if you keep R below one, you can kind of find your way through. If R goes above one, for whatever reason, whether that's because you get the list wrong or compliance is not quite what you want or you import too many cases, it's just there's so many moving parts here. That it's difficult to be sure what did what. Now, I described it yesterday. I'm not sure if this works for you. If you imagine you had a big bucket, an empty big bucket, we're in lockdowns, 23rd of March, and we're going to put some things in the bucket that we're going to open. So some of that's easy. So we decided to open schools. I think that's the right choice. Yeah. Other people could argue that maybe you should open something else, but I think opening schools and nursery schools for kids, now my bucket's a third full. Right. So what else am I going to put in it? So let's put care home visiting in it, because that seems really important. So let's put hospital visiting in it. Now the bucket's three quarters full. What else do you want? Do you want places of worship? Do you want elite sport? Do you want cinemas? So now you're thinking, no, now my bucket's full. So that's the real challenge with why can I do this and not do this? Why can I go to the pub and I can't go to Celtic Park? Because if the bucket's full, the bucket's full. You got to take something out to put something back in again. And it's so hard. And some of that is advice, of course. So our public health advice is schools are more important than elite sport. You might not like that, but I think that's fair. But how you then make choices between sport versus retail versus hospitality, that comes down to decision-making by politicians, taking the best advice they can from the financial people, the public health people, the social policy people, and making choices.
James, when we look at the changes that Jason's talking about there, and the fact that we are accelerating faster than we would like to. What effect is that happening on Scottish rugby, on both the grassroots and the top tier of the game?
Yeah, so we're currently at a level where we've restarted the season. We've effectively managed to can last season. We got professional sport, or certainly from a rugby point of view, back on the pitch. But we've done it very carefully. We've done it with advice from the government. We started, you know, training socially distanced, and we gradually moved in. We've been able to do that because, of course, we've put in our own testing regime. We have a code of conduct. We can, by and large, ensure what our players do. That's different at grassroots level. We got back to where we could do a little bit of controlled contact. But as the First Minister said the other day, there's a pause at the moment. And because of that pause, we can't move forwards with grassroots. And indeed, because of what Jason and his colleagues are telling us, my particular instinct was to speak to council and to speak to the authorities, and perhaps looking at pausing rugby. So I think it's important to support the government. It's important to support public health. We have to minimise our activity in order to prevent, you know, any drain on the NHS. And we have to be mindful of the priority here for our population is to keep them healthy. We would promote physical activity because that promotes mental well-being, and that promotes, helps to fight the virus. The professional side will take its lead from the government. At the moment we proceed, we've got the season underway, but we're mindful of the fact that things could change tomorrow.
And that's a key point, isn't it, Jason? The fact that we've always said it's fast moving, it changes the whole time. But even in the space of the next 2 or 3 days, this is Monday afternoon, we're talking, the space of the next 3 or 4 days, the picture could be vastly different again.
Yes, it could. And none of that will be done lightly, Chris. But none of it will be done at any level other than to protect your family and mine. I know that sounds a bit hyperbolic. It sounds a bit ridiculous to be talking in those terms, but that's the kind of terms we're talking about. I've got a pal, 41 years old, paramedic. I maybe told his story on here before. Plays fives, a couple of young kids, got the virus on the 9th of April, nearly killed him. 3.5 months of illness. No pre-existing conditions, nothing wrong with him. Fitter than me, which isn't a hard bar, a high bar, but it has done really badly. Mm-hmm. And it is now back at work, 12-hour shifts again, and can't do a full week. And he's gutted. So it's not a virus to be taken lightly. And I know for some people listening, it feels abstract. It feels like somebody else's, feels like a long way away. Mm-hmm. But it can get in your house and get in your household pretty quickly. I should say, to since James is here, I honestly think the protocols and procedures, the work that the SRU, the medical teams have done, has been an example to the rest of sport and the rest of the world. Honestly, it's been outstanding. You haven't rushed. In fact, there's been a couple of private calls between the doc and me where I've been going faster than him. So he's slowed you down, and I think he's absolutely right to do so. I think that conservatism has served you well, and it's why your professional game is still intact. If you had gone too quickly, your professional game would be shut.
But to save his bosses, Jason, we are very privileged to have the very best rugby doctor in the world working with Scottish Rugby, and we all know that. Chris and I know that firsthand from the amount of times he's put us back together as well.
Jason, I think he's talking about Sam Hewitt and...
exactly. We've got a couple, not James.
I wasn't going to be quite as polite, Al. I was going to say, well, Jason and James wouldn't make a great three-legged partners, would they, if they're going at different speeds?
That's true. I'm not sure getting you two back to fitness was a benefit for Scottish rugby, wasn't it?
Oh, we could share a few stories.
Getting Rachel back.
Oh, I'm massive,
now you're talking.
Well, that was the other thing he probably did. He probably told the coaches we were unavailable at times. We were available just to help the cause. Anyway, James, we were talking about the acceleration and the R number and all the different factors. Talked there about grassroots rugby, and you rightly pointed out safety. safety first. What other challenges is that given to you and your team as far as the professional game? There's more now, far more now. I think there used to be a view that, you know, a positive test would take a player out, but there's far more than just a positive test.
There's so many nuances, it would be difficult to actually educate people because we're still being educated ourselves. Sadly, I've been involved in a number of discussions, and even those discussions have varied. I think what you have to say is that any hint of a positive case, we close things down very quickly. We're very mindful of trying to protect both wider society and closer to home, the bubble that is the pro teams. And that's very difficult. And it actually has given me a great insight into how difficult a job it is for the contact tracers working in our community. And it really is a minefield. So safety is paramount, you know, making sure that we try, as the government are trying to do just now, stop the virus in its tracks. It's easier in a small select group than it is in a population. And you know, I'm glad I'm not in public health at the moment.
Particularly when you open up society, that the public health leads tell me that in peacetime, non-pandemic time, if I asked you how many people you were in contact with in the last 48 hours, it's usually about 30. So just in average life, you might be close to 30 people. Now, even with the restrictions we've got on just now, the average is somewhere about half a dozen for most people. And that's difficult enough. But in lockdown, that number was only one. Mm-hmm. So people tended to be with their spouse or their kids or just in their own households. Now the contact tracers are trying to find chains of transmission that go all over the place. So they went to work or they went to the pub or they played sport here or they played five-a-sides or touch rugby over here. And suddenly you're at a list of 10 people who have all got contacts of their own, all got stories and detective stories of their own. James is right, it gets really difficult to interrupt those chains of transmission. And sport has had to help us with that. So I've learned an awful lot about goalkeeping coaches at St Mirren and who they engage with and how that training works. And I've actually seen your training protocols and where the ball moves from player A to player B and how long player B has it. That's the level of detail that you guys have had to have so that we can then decide with the health protection teams what contact tracing actually means if you're doing rugby training.
And that's obviously the sessions are all filmed. They're filmed from two or three different angles. They're filmed from a drone. Yep. The players wear GPS. So you have to correlate all that and you build up a picture of who's been in contact with who effectively.
And the basic rule, I mean, it's not an exact science, of course, but the basic rule is within 2 meters for 15 minutes or more. Mm-hmm. But if you're right up close to somebody, so if you're in a ruck or if you're in a scrum, then that's pretty close contact, never mind the 15 minutes. So, and then you've got to take into account that there are the virus can move on stuff. Mm-hmm. So that could be a kid's toy in a nursery school or a rugby ball at yep. training. So you've got to also be slightly careful. So who is the positive case? Who's the index case? Where were they? When were they? And did they touch that gym machine? So were they on the treadmill or did they use that weights machine? Were they rigorous in the cleaning before next player came in? So all of those things need worked out. And the SRU are responsible for most of that, not us. You guys are responsible for most of that. And then we make the best informed decision we can to give you the best advice we can. Test and Protect does its thing as if it was a call centre or a rugby stadium. Test and Protect doesn't care. Test and Protect only cares to protect the people. And that worked, I think, in the cases in the last few weeks in rugby, that's worked pretty well.
It's worked very well. Yeah. Chris, it's an incredibly complex, you've got what we call the heat map. You look at the associations that's happened. You can drill down to the fact that somebody was within 1 meter or 2 meters. You can get the cumulative time. All of that gets put into the pot along with the detailed, you know, I've had coaches explaining to public health consultants the detail of certain drills, and they've listened painfully and decided this is what we need to do. So at the end of the day, the decision is not within our hands. We provide the information to the public health clinicians, and they give us an informed decision. And right, like it or lump it, we certainly abide by that.
Respect
that is the only way that we can bring things to a halt.
Mm-hmm. But James, and on that, you know, you're working towards the Scotland boys going into camp next week, and we're talking about ourselves here and what we're doing. But I guess the challenge, another challenge which we're going to have to take on, is others coming to us, visiting teams, and them having to adopt the procedures we put in place. How big a challenge is it, or how big a challenge is it in general to make sure that other teams visiting around the world are going to be able to adapt to what we're putting in place at Murrayfield?
Yeah, so we're looking at having Georgia visit. We're looking at having Fiji visit. We're looking at having France visit. I've just come off a meeting where, you know, we've all agreed a 59-page document, numerous appendices as to behaviour standards, chartering of flights, bubbles in hotels, not getting home for considerable periods, and in particular, serial testing. So all of our professional players are currently in teams where they're being tested and have been tested for several months. That gives you some security because the test is only a snapshot, and I prefer not to call it testing for us. We're screening our players as part of a protocol, as part of a wider ethos, as it were. That's one element. The rest of the elements about sticking to facts, face coverings, I would pride ourselves in that perhaps we went into lockdown from the Scottish Rugby before the rest of the country went into lockdown. We worked from home 10 days before it was mooted for the rest of the general public. So we've endeavoured to be very cautious about that. But as far as the teams playing together, it's a case of we're all signing up to the right protocols, and it's incumbent on us to stick to those protocols. And look, you know, Jason knows, if somebody steps out of line in Scotland, they'll certainly hear from me very early on.
Yes, they will. I have no doubt about it. I think, Jamie, there is a layer of complexity now. International games in whatever sport add a new layer. And I think you're as ready as you can be for that. But that has to be medical team to medical team. And it has to be ingrained into the players and the coaches and the staff that this is how it's going to be. Every country I know of is taking this really seriously, whether it's inside sport or inside their populations. No, nobody is treating it casually. That doesn't mean you won't get cases. And you just need to drop your guard really briefly, and there could be cases. And that gets more complicated if now there's cross-border health protection teams, but we're ready for that. We can manage that. And it's one of the reasons why we can get sport back, because it's important for society that Georgia come and play and Fiji come and play. We want to encourage that, but within a safe environment. And not all sports can do what Formula One have got, a very, very rigid bubble. You can't get in or out. If you go out and buy a toothbrush, you're excluded for 2 weeks. You literally join the bubble and you go in private jets. You drive in the trucks. You can't do anything else. There's very few sports beyond probably golf, tennis, and Formula One that could do that. So what we're doing in rugby internationally is at one level down from that, but as tight as you can make it so that you don't bring risk into those squads.
Just Jason, we've touched on playing and training at grassroots level. We've touched on playing and training and all the mitigating factors that need to go into place that James and his team are putting in from a professional point of view. The other point from a rugby point of view is viewing the game, is trying to get to watch the game live. And now, maybe an impossible question to answer as we talk about the fact that so much is moving so quickly, but based on the fact of the successful pilot event back in August, when there was 700, and when do you envisage we may be able to get fans back in watching some of these games we're talking about?
So that event went really well. The two subsequent football ones a couple of weeks later also went very well. We learned a lot about how to get local people to come, so people who could walk or cycle, or some people brought cars, but not a big burden on public transport. I think we learned quite a lot about stewarding. And we all know the importance of stewarding with 65,000. Actually, the importance of stewarding for 750, almost more important for people exiting and entering. And the same was true at the two football pilots. Unfortunately, the pandemic has put paid temporarily to that progression we had in mind, to get a few more hundred, to get we had plans the following weekend at rugby to move into a bigger crowd. I'm confident that we'll get crowds back. I just can't tell you when. I don't think we'll have full stadia until the summer, probably, until we get science that gets us out of this. I mean, I don't know if you've watched any kind of vintage footage on TV of your own games or games from a year ago. It feels like a different world when you see the crowds jammed into the tennis or even walking around the golf, never mind a big stadium. So that feels a long way away. But I'm hopeful we'll get back to that progressive prototyping, in particularly in football and rugby, because they're the big stadia events that we've got in Scotland. And I'm hopeful that if we can get the prevalence down, we can restart that process. And that's still on the stocks. The Minister for Sport still makes that case regularly. But just now, as we said earlier, the bucket is full and you can't put anything else in the bucket.
That's good. That's good to know. And I suppose, to continue the optimistic vein, the longer this virus is around, the more we learn about it, the more we learn how to manage it. And, you know, if we do kind of all these protocols and processes, they'll improve as well. Do you think it'll become easier to live with it the longer it's here?
For sure, Chris. And I mean, it's completely different from March. I mean, we know so much more about treatment if you're seriously unwell. We know, unfortunately, some bad things. So we know that some people get chronic disease from it. We didn't know that in March and April. So some people, even if they recover, remain unwell for some time. We know a lot more about the nature of the virus, and it appears not to be mutating and getting away. So the vaccine scientists need a stable virus in order to design a vaccine. So that's why you can't do a vaccine against the common cold, for instance, because it runs away from us. You can't chase it quick enough. This one appears to be stable. The vaccine scientists are pretty confident and getting more confident all the time. Now, vaccines are not straightforward things, and we need 6 billion doses of it. This is not a problem for Scotland. It's a problem for Yemen and Syria and Scotland. So we've got to be careful, because there's all kinds of ethical dilemmas about who do you vaccinate in the world, and do you do all the over 80s in the world before you do the whole of France? Or, you know, so there's decisions to be made in there by the WHO and governments. But I'm confident, as confident as I can be, that science will get us out the other end of this. It will probably be a vaccine, but there's also some really interesting stuff going on about testing. So could you design a test eventually, not yet, where you could take a test every day and it would be cheap, it would be quick, it probably wouldn't be 100% accurate, but at a population level, it would help you. So it would allow you to be green or red. Sounds like science fiction, and it is science fiction presently, to be clear. It does not exist, despite what you read in some papers. But the concept is a good one. Yeah. So if you spit into a bottle, it looks a bit like a pregnancy test. You get a line, you get a pink line for yes, a green line for no, and off you go about your business or whatever. So I think science will help us out of it. And even the Donald Trump story over the last few days has brought into light some of the new drugs and therapeutics that are being tested and trialed. Now, whether you should give them to Donald Trump or not, that's up to them. I mean that there is definitely work going on that suggests we will find therapeutic drugs that will help those who have got mild disease.
So a lot of talk around a circuit breaker and the opportunity to maybe buy some time or empty some out that bucket. What can you tell us about that?
So the theory of the circuit breaker, or the temporal interruption, which isn't quite as catchy, is that you give your society a short, sharp shock, and it does two things. It gets the R number down fast, but almost more importantly, it gets your total number of infected. It gets your, what we would call your infectious pool, down. So an R number of 1.5 with an infectious pool of 300 is very different from an R of 1.5 with an infectious pool of 300,000. So it gets your overall prevalence down, and the scientists, the modelers, suggest that if you do that for 2 weeks, roughly, you buy yourself about 28 days. And that 28 days is useful because it's winter. We get flu vaccination. It buys us more time for science. So 28 days doesn't feel like much. But 28 days getting towards a vaccine in March is actually quite a big deal. But there's a cost to the temporal interruption or the circuit breaker. There's a cost to those who own the businesses. There's a cost to those who have who we then restrict more fully, whether it's a business owner or a worker or a family. Or so you got it. We're back to the really hard conversation we had at the beginning about decision making. So how do you decide if those costs are worth it? And that's what's going on over the weekend and in the next few days about the economic, the public health, and the societal effects of a circuit breaker. And is that something that would be worth it? And I wish there was a manual that you could take off the wall that said, that just had a yes, no answer in it, but it there just isn't.
Doc, not long now until the boys head back into Scotland camp, and the women as well. I know you've been working really hard on how that's all going to look, but could you just give us an overview of how the men's and women's camps are going to look? Are you going to have a bubble for the men? How is it with players coming in and out? How are you going to be able to manage it and foresee all that?
Yeah, so the bubble concept means different things to different people. What I would say is what we're aiming to do is to keep the guys as secure as possible. We're undertaking serial testing. They're already being tested in their own teams. When they come into us, that's an extension of that. It's all about, you know, ensuring good behaviours. They've got to keep themselves when they're at home. They've got to be mindful of who in the family are interacting with who else. And that's been going on for several months now, Jamie. So, you know, and reasonably successfully. It's a very difficult thing to ask of people, because we're asking, you know, the population to be careful. We're asking our player population to be even more careful in the sacrifices that they make, enable them to play. And I know that the women's team, they've already, you know, they've been training for several weeks now. They've started testing in the same way that the men are. They have an exceptionally difficult challenge because many of them are amateur. They don't have that as their main job. And so, again, their behaviours and how they interact, whether they're working away from home, whether they're working in an office, whether they're working in some other field, all of these factors come into play. And then when we're in camp, of course, what we're asking people is, you can't just socialise in the same way that we were doing before. When we're not on the training field, you need to maintain social distancing. You need to wear your face covering. You need to regularly wash your hands. You need to tell us whether you've got any symptoms. You need to do regular temperature checks. It's quite an undertaking.
That means less games of table tennis in the team room, Doc.
It means there is no team room.
It means no games of table tennis, no team room. That is the reality that we're faced with. It means social distancing for team meetings, either outside. Or if we're privileged to use inside because we're a tested population, it means wide spacing. It means perhaps using a lecture theatre style for 30 people spaced over what would normally be occupied by up to 500 people. And the level of detail that, you know, it means that lunch, for instance, is served over three sittings. Nobody sits opposite each other. You're sitting diagonally spaced out. A table that previously housed maybe 12, 14 people will house 4 to 6 people. I cannot, you know, reiterate how much planning has gone into getting the guys and the girls back to playing, and those are the sacrifices they're needing to make. So socialising is kind of out of the window.
On that, James, as you get closer to all top level rugby, test rugby in particular, it was always about keeping things as simple as possible. It was always about getting rid of distractions and making sure that everybody, the team in particular, could focus on the game itself. You can't get rid of this. It's got to be with you right up until you take the park. Warm-ups, post-match, it's there all the time. So one for James and probably for Rach as well. But James, firstly, how are the players reacting to that? And Rach, from your point of view, how difficult is it to narrow that focus back to performance as well?
If I might go first, I'd say it's very difficult for the players, but they're stepping up to the mark. Having watched the behaviours in the two pro teams, having been involved with their testing, having been in and watched some of the training, it's very rare for them to have slip-ups. Occasionally, you've got to remind them about face coverings in particular. Occasionally, you've got to remind them about social distancing. It is so important to get the behaviours right. Sorry, Rich.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's, I think, taking a bit of time. I think everything is so different. You know, camp is usually such a sociable place in terms of, particularly for us women, you know, coming together from lots of different places and catching up on what you've been doing and having fun for your friends. But at the moment, it is business. It is, you come, you train, you finish training, and you are social distance. You know, even when we sit and have our lunch at the Orium, you know, we're miles apart from each other, sat completely isolated, and the same goes for when we get back to the hotel from 5 p.m. onwards, you're pretty much completely by yourself. So it's just supporting each other through that, I think, is a big thing. You know, we've had two camps now. The first camp, it was really difficult. It was really weird. Whereas this camp, you know, the other thing is we train 24/7 with our masks on as well. So that's really hard. It makes high intensity rugby extremely difficult. And in the first camp, like James says, you know, we were having to be reminded quite a lot about our behaviours around that. But the second camp, like, I can't fault the girls. Like, there was almost, I don't think, any times we had to be reminded to get that right. And so, yeah, I think it's just a case of getting used to it and really being diligent with it, because, you know, we've seen in a lot of different sports and within rugby itself, the impact that can have just one slip up on that, and the impact that can have on your whole team as well. So, you know, we, as much as anyone, just are desperate for rugby to go ahead. So I guess it's just making those sacrifices.
Well, Jason, I know you're a busy man and you have to shut off, but we do very much appreciate you coming on to the podcast again and updating us all. We'll get you back on soon in a few weeks for a further update. But once again, thank you on behalf of everybody at Scottish Rugby.
Thanks for having me, and it's great to see you all.
Doc, pleasure as always. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll speak to you soon.
Cheers.
Cheers. See you later.
Well, the Guinness Pro 14 returned to action last weekend. Al, I'll come to you first and get your take on the first game that was between Glasgow away to Connacht. Not the result that Glasgow wanted, but I suppose there is maybe some positives you can take from that result.
Yeah, there was definite positives. I mean, Mossy was obviously commentating on it. I watched it with no sound. That wasn't because I was just out for dinner and it was on in the background. Because clearly I'd want to hear your insight. Glasgow had opportunities and didn't take them. Like, they created enough, and that's the positives. But and they scored a reasonable amount of points, but they didn't defend all that well at times and gave away a few soft scores. So you saw it live, Mossy?
Yeah, I think so. I think the big kind of headline thing is discipline, isn't it? There were so many penalties on both sides, and I know, I mean, Glasgow, I suppose, it's about 5 weeks since they played. They had those two games and then 5 weeks. So they're maybe keep going back to the new interpretations or the existing laws or the breakdown. But there's a lot there that I think Glasgow can tidy up on in terms of discipline and penalties. And that was the theme of the game, really. Connacht started really well. Glasgow fought back into it. And as you say, dominated the kind of most of the first half, other than the first 10 minutes, but only scored that late try with only points they got. And then the game really opened up in the second half. We said in commentary that we were expecting quite an open, fast game, and there's a lot of attack and threat on the pitch. And then at 7-3 at half-time, or at 3-0, two minutes before half-time, we were kind of doubting what we were thinking was going to happen. But it did liven up. It was sharp in the second half. Discipline's a big issue for Glasgow to get fixed. And then, you know, the tries they scored were excellent, but you're scoring 24 points away from home, still coming up short. You just have to tighten a few things up. So losing bonus point is better than nothing. This of all seasons, I think, desperate we'd have wanted off to get off to a winning start.
How relieved do you think Adam Hastings was that it didn't finish within 3 points after that one in front of the sticks.
We've all been there. We've all been there. It wasn't that great. Jack Carty had one very similar. Just was it before it or after? I think just before it as well. For those who didn't see it, it was a couple of kind of what looked fairly straightforward penalty misses, but disappointing. But yeah, I suppose rust plays a part, but we'll have a proper look at that later.
I was going to say, I'm sure Adam will be working hard with his kicking coach over the next few days to get that fixed.
To avoid that, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, a question for you. Hugh Jones seems to really be taking the role of fullback in his stride, you know, an ex-fullback yourself. What have you made of him and stepping into that position?
Yeah, same as everybody else, really. I think he's done really well. He's been enthusiastic to play there. He fits the bill perfectly. I said in commentary on Saturday that I actually think the position really suits him. He's a brilliant broken field runner. He's attack minded. He's good under the high ball. He kicks well at hand. And the reason I think it really suits him is you tend to get more space at 15 than you do at 13. And you know, like, I just think on that outside arc, he can pick his lines. He can come back against the grain when he's attacking. He's a good tackler. He's quick. So I think it really suits him. I think it does. But the best thing about the weekend was his positional play. Like, Jack Carty is a good 10. It plays for Connacht, his international 10. He's quite difficult to play against in terms of he can disguise his kicks. He did get a little bit of joy, Carty, but on the whole, Hugh covered that backfield and, more importantly, managed his wingers and Robin Aaron and Tommy Seymour working as a three really well. And that's the bit that gives you confidence that, you know, someone with the skill set of Hugh could easily play fullback, but you actually need that commanding kind of role of organising the whole time with the back three to make sure the grass is covered. So he's doing really well.
It opened up the opportunity for, well, I mean, who knows what combination would have gone, but I thought Nick Grigg played well as well. Like, talk about positives coming out of the Glasgow camp. He took his try well, but got himself on the ball and hit the line hard.
Yeah, I mean, they did attack pretty well. There was at times I thought Glasgow were a wee bit narrow and it wasn't that fluent. Then you remind yourself, it's the first game of the season and they haven't played for 5 weeks. So, of course, there's going to be some inaccuracies, but when they did attack, you know, certainly through more of the second half, I thought they were excellent and found some attacking space. But to lose that, kind of 28-24 in the opening game of the season, will still, for all the positives, it'll still really frustrate them.
Let's look at Edinburgh now. A disappointing result for them at home against Ospreys. It just seems at the moment, Mossy, that momentum might have been lost for Edinburgh after three defeats in a row.
Yeah, I mean, that was the fourth defeat in a row, which is disappointing. It's that's what, three games at the end of last season. This, the new one, there was only a couple of weeks between, or a week really between them. So it's disappointing. But I don't think there's any hangover. I don't think it's Friday's or Saturday's performance was anything to do with last season. I just think it was a miserable night, which isn't an excuse because Ospreys played really well, but just the high volume of errors didn't allow Edinburgh any foothold in the game to implement the game plan or carry out the game plan or change the game plan. It was just too many errors. And partly down to the conditions, partly down to the individual errors, which will frustrate the players themselves. Ospreys are how they only won two games last season. I think they only won, was it two games all season? And the players have got in the field, you think just off the top of your head, Almond Jones, Justin Tipperick, in their pack, really quality players. You've got Stephen Myler and Reese Webb at halfback. They're experienced and they helped on Saturday just with that experience. But even with Edinburgh,
I thought Reese Webb was terrific at managing that game.
He was. He was kind of suited for that. He kicked well. He could have kicked better, but he kicked well at the right times. But I just think he's a physical nine as well, and just the amount of kind of pressure in around the breakdown, in around every kick chase, that extra physicality can force the errors that were a result of some elements of poor skill, but also really bad conditions. But he did. He played well. I thought Myler was excellent as well at 10. Obviously the tries they scored were a couple of them were long range, but Edinburgh will be disappointed. They go away to Munster this weekend, which Munster just got through the 81st minute win down at Scarlett's, and Glasgow then play the Scarlets. So this weekend on Sunday, I think. But I think Edinburgh need to get a win on the road. And I think the beauty of it on Saturday was that, for me, the mistakes were obvious. So what you need to fix and what needs to address was obvious. And I've no doubt that we're working on it this week.
I think Jamie, that one thing from an Edinburgh point of view, Moshi mentions the mistakes, and they compounded the mistakes because there was a nervousness about dropping the ball. That, you know, when you make a few early mistakes, that comes in. I thought Ospreys, to give them the credit, managed the conditions really well. Really said, they scored some of their tries from far out, but they kicked well. They didn't want the ball at times. And it was said in commentary, I think it was maybe Big Jim had said, like, times like this, you want to give it away, play territory. So the pressure kept building on Edinburgh and wasn't there for Ospreys, because they had the territory, they were kicking well, they played the conditions well. The line speed of the defence, I thought, was brilliant throughout the whole game. Like, and when it's wet, it always takes you that extra half second to catch a ball and give it, or even just to catch it and carry it. And Edinburgh were getting that half second taken away from them by the Ospreys. And the same with their kick chase as well. You know, classic making an all right kick, a fantastic kick, by getting competing for it, getting underneath it, making it difficult to gather. I thought that was a point of difference, the speed at which Ospreys chased that ball and made sure that everything was so hard for Edinburgh that they ended up making more errors than they would have liked.
How do you get out of that cycle? I suppose, Rach, you're still playing. If you know, you feel it on your own side, you're making a lot of errors. How do you kind of stop that momentum against you when you don't really want the ball? Because if you get the ball, it's so wet, so miserable, you're going to potentially have another error. At the same time, if you give the ball back to Ospreys, the chances are they're probably going to pump it up in the air and you're going to be catching the pressure. So do you just put up your jumper, for use of a better phrase?
I think it's about trying to suck momentum out of them to then build your own. So however you got to do that. And if for some of it, it can just be playing a bit of boring rugby and keeping ball in hand and just stopping them having it. Mm-hmm. Like Al says, it can be really tiring playing in those conditions and playing that type of rugby. So it's being a bit savvy, I guess, as well with how you use your time and that kind of thing. But yeah, I think you've just got to weather the storm to some extent and soak up some pressure. And when you've got the ball, keep the ball for prolonged periods of time to try and sap out that momentum that they've got. But yeah, it is so difficult, particularly when the conditions are bad and you're on the back foot, to kind of turn it around.
I suppose you make a really good point there, Rach, doesn't she, Al, that when the ball's out of play, you can still control the speed of the game as well. So the time it takes you to get to the line out, time it takes you to get to the scrum. At times you might want that to be really quick. You might want to get the ball in and away, but in conditions like that, you may just actually try and frustrate the opposition or disrupt the momentum when the ball's not even in play.
I would have got the ball off the park a little bit more at crucial times.
Would you put the high cuts through it, the steel toe caps, put it in the stand-up?
I'd probably put a cross-field kick and just to make sure, enough of the nonsense, I would ask you to get the ball off the park a little bit more at the right times. Because Edinburgh's line of defence is good, and in those conditions, you can take, I'm simplifying this right down, but you can take away the easy options from a line out and force them to go to something difficult and maybe try and force some errors from the opposition. Ospreys got the competing for the kicks. They got that spot on. So there needed to be something else from Edinburgh. It's all in those conditions. An awful lot is about how you start the game, though, because you could see it building up on Edinburgh and the pressure building up on them. And, you know, some guys not as experienced potentially as some of the other players at Edinburgh have in their squad, but they'll learn a lot from that. It's disappointing to lose at home in your first game, especially off the back of having such a successful season, but it's by no means the wheels are off. Even taking into the account the kind of tail end of last season, by definition, the tail end of last season was the hardest games that they would play in. Yeah. They were tough knockout games.
And it was, you know, say, you know, they didn't start particularly well, didn't deal with the first kickoff, but then did go 7-0 up, and then as you see, momentum went against them. I think it went up to 20-7 against them. So it's all 20 unanswered points over that however more 45 minute period. It's one that will frustrate the Edinburgh players and coaches, but we've got a chance to put it right in Munster this weekend.
Wet weather strategy. It was big Shane Monroe's at Glasgow as a Glasgow coach. And the Scotland women's coach, obviously, right,
Shane used to
all plans galore that we'd work on for a week, and then if it started raining, Shane would just pull out top pocket the wet weather strategy and put it down. He loved it. It was a bit that he owned.
Alan Tate used to have a phrase, if it was a wet ball, have wet hands. So he would, I was like, what? He reckoned, came for the league, wet ball, wet hands. I don't understand it, but ball's wet, get your hands wet.
And Rachel, just talk us through what you're up to today. I believe you were involved in, was it a premiership, a virtual launch for the premiership down there?
Yeah, so the Premier 15 starts this weekend. So women's kind of elite game down in England. Kicked off on Saturday, and today was, so we usually have a launch with the captains either at Twickenham or at a venue, but today it was on Zoom. It was pretty low key, but just kicking off and chatting about the season and getting back to playing, which is pretty exciting.
Support Scotland this season as one. Scottish Rugby has introduced a new membership for fans at home and abroad to back the sport in Scotland during the COVID-19 pandemic. Sign up for Scotland now at scottishrugby.org. That's all from us this week on the official Scottish Rugby podcast. As always, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with more exclusive content.